Now I forget where we were when we sort of finished. Did we have a finishing place?
Yes, we did, in a sense. So this is a second interview with Mr. Dick Dawson, and it's taking place on April 1st, 2009, and it's a follow-up to an earlier session where we were looking at Mr. Dawson's career, and we sort of skipped around a bit with
Yes.
that. And there are a few things that I'd like to cover today, and I marked some of these items down. We touched upon your experience with Thunder Bay, but not a whole lot. So maybe we should start with that, how you first became involved in Thunder Bay, I think.
Yes. Okay. I'd come here in 59. And I first came in 58, and I came to work permanently in 59. And of course, the Seaway opened that year. That was the opening year of the St. Lawrence Seaway, and which of itself is, a significant mark in the in any kind of a history that you would be playing, because it spelt the arrival for the first time in Thunder Bay of Psalters, for a beginning. We never had any Psalters prior to that. Although we never did get as many as we thought we might get, and there's a good reason. They're not built for it. They take a much deeper draft per ton carry than the Laker vessels that are designed for it, and so on. But we then saw the tremendous increase in the Canadian fleet of domestic ships, a big building splurge all through 60, 61, 2, 3. Building the many fleets, the Papa Christides fleet, the Meisner fleet, the CSL fleet, the Upper Lakes, and everybody increased their fleets. And we ended up with something like, I forget, but you'd have to check the numbers, but at least 80 or 90 ships of various sizes, and there were many of those were what we would call Seaway Max, 26 feet draft and roughly a million bushels, 30,000 tons. Something like that, maybe a little less. But so that business that emerged in the early 60s, which was an enormous increase over anything we'd seen since before World War II, and I think it was 63 that broke the 1928 record for exports out of A Thunder Bay and or the total of Canada as well. Everybody was going as hard as they could, and you saw all the satellite countries buying in distress, with Russia unable to feed them, and then Russia itself came in heavily in 63 and again in 66. So the writing was on the wall that the Russian system was failing. Agriculture in Russia was not working. So you timed by luck or whatever, some good judgment, that the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway, a huge increase in the capacity to move with a very large increase in demand. And so those were very boom years, right on through into the 70s. There was a It's not quite true. There was a lull after 66, 67. And I think we may have got a little bit spoilt by those previous 9 years of good times, and we got caught a little bit. The International Wheat Agreement was theoretically in place. It was an ineffective agreement. It was a poor concept, and it didn't work very well. And the moment that there was tough times, everybody broke it. And Canada was one of the few people who tried to hold on and not break it. And it cost us dearly because others were doing all the business at well below the internationally agreed prices. And we would sort of try to take the high ground and not break the agreement, but eventually they were forced to follow suit. And
Before you go on, there's a couple of things that I wanted to ask in relation to the two items that you mentioned. You were mentioning that they didn't, Thunder Bay didn't get the number of salties that anticipated, and that was because of the elevators and the slips and their structure.
I think it was because of the economics, simply proving that you could put 30,000 tons of grain into a designed super laker on the Great Lakes and get it down to Montreal or Baie-Comeau or Sept-Îles or Quebec or wherever and get it another elevation into another ship, into an ocean ship, which again would be bigger, much bigger. You know, we were moving into the 35 and 40 and 45,000 tonners and on. And that was a more economic cost equation than bringing a salty up to the lakes, limited in size, unable to load its full capacity because of the fresh water. It has to stop in Montreal on the way out anyway to top up the extra 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 tons it needs. You know, it's a 32,000 ton ship coming up to Thunder Bay for 25, picking up another 7 after it's got down there. So the economics, the sheer economics of bringing a salty up into Thunder Bay was not as good as the Laker movement. And the ones that did come up had often come in on inbound cargo and were coming in anyway and were happy to get cargo out. You know, but
what would they be bringing in?
Oh, we saw big movements of specialized steel up into Toledo from Japan, and this was particularly special kinds of steel. There were other things coming in, motor cars and stuff. But it's not a big movement in, that's for sure. And but I think it was that the primary reason was that the ships with the new Seaway could beat them on a net FOB East Coast cost. It was a cheaper way to get on board an ocean boat, and the ocean boat you got on board was bigger, and the bigger the ships carry a lower freight rate again. So the ocean boat was getting a lower freight rate than the salty equivalent.
The second part of my question had to do with, did Duluth have an advantage over Thunder Bay in that regard, or just because of what you were saying about the economics of the Seaway and having to load up in closer to the ocean anyway, made them both pretty similar from a structural standpoint?
Yes, there was no real competitive advantage at Duluth. They did have some slightly more modern elevators, which would have been a little bigger, a little quicker, a little faster loading than some of our older equipment. But I think that was marginal. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was significant. There's no reason to believe that Duluth had an advantage over Thunder Bay.
What was your involvement with the Cargill elevator in Thunder Bay?
Well, as you move grain through Thunder Bay, as you know, you yourself as a company can't control how much grain you get through the elevator. The assignment of the cars to the elevators and so on is very much a wheat board decision. So just because you've got a chain of a supply chain of control of management from country elevators in the west into Thunder Bay, onto your own ships, into your own elevator at Baie-Comeau, going into your own ocean ships, going to your own elevator in Amsterdam, which we were doing, doesn't give you much of an advantage in Canada. And if there was an advantage in Duluth, it was that the elevators there were part of supply chains of their own managerial control, and that doesn't exist in Canada. And
so are you saying that a Cargill boxcar that came in
didn't necessarily go to the Cargill elevator?
Okay. one there just to receive whatever.
Yes.
Now, when you talk about the wheat board's involvement, that would be for wheat board grains.
Yes.
But you'd be shipping other things out of Thunder Bay as well?
Yeah, we did, but nothing like the volumes that you had in wheat. I mean, there's always been a movement of flax, there's been a movement of rye. During those early years, there was an increasing movement of canola. You got to remember that the canola shipments in the early 60s were 500,000 tons less. I mean, the crop was 500,000 tons. It was later on into the 70s that became a significant movement. And today, of course, there have been years when the dollar value of the canola crop has exceeded wheat. Not in volume, but in dollar value. You notice a shift there. Wheat remains the largest in dollar volume, in physical volume. And in the canola games and so on, you could have a much greater control. We actually moved a unit train of sunflower seed to Thunder Bay as an experiment in 1974 or 5, just after we built Elm Creek, the big inland, first of the big inland terminals. Actually, it was the second of the big inland terminals. The first inland terminal was built by a farmer group in Weyburn. And then Cargo built two, one at Elm Creek and one at Rosetown. And the concept there was to copy what the Americans were doing so successfully, loading much bigger units. Instead of sending 3 cars to that elevator and 4 cars to that elevator and 5 cars to that elevator all over the prairies, loading a minimum of 50 cars lots. We started with 18 car spots at a time and then moved up to 25 and then to 50 where they are today. And of course, that's so much more efficient for the railroad. And running around, dropping off 2 or 3 cars here and there, and then going back, a week later to pick them up, pretty inefficient. And so that change was very slow in coming and didn't really start to accelerate until after the change in the statutory freight rate and the end of the Crow.
So you said that it was sent as an experiment, was it?
Well, it was in sunflower seeds, mm-hmm. and that was a little bit different. They even had their own freight rate. I mean, you can't, on a per ton basis, they're so light, it's like loading feathers. So that was a peculiar, unusual business. But with normal grains, we didn't really see any modernization efficiencies coming in until the initial first break was 83, when the first change was made, and it kept quite a few of the things. And the crow rate was phased out over time, and then by 93 it was completely gone. But during that period and on into there, you started to see these efficiencies appearing, and that's been a huge structural change. And it's probably the root of the change in corporate structures, the ultimate disappearance of the Manitoba Pool, Alberta Pool, and SAS Pool, and UGG, and so on. They all lived and came up and grew up and were designed for a world of equity, not efficiency. One sort of regrets that one can't have both of those. You don't have to throw away equity completely with the baby and the bathwater story, but the efficiency of being able to get to larger elevators, I think at that time the average farm truck was traveling about 6 or 7 miles and getting to an elevator. And even now, they're only averaging 20, or something. It's amazing that they've dropped from, a high. At one point, we had 5,000 elevators in 2,000 towns. And now we've got, I'm not sure where we are today, 500 or 600 elevators and so on. And of course, you had, in those days, we had 350,000 farmers on the prairie too, 400,000. And today, 80% of our crop is probably grown by 25,000 farmers, 30,000 maybe.
Did your work include managing the elevator in Thunder Bay?
No, I never did have a direct responsibility for managing that elevator. We don't have anybody here that did. Yes, we do. There is a fellow here, Yvon Chabot, came. He was the manager at Baie-Comeau, and then he came here after we bought National Grain, and Cargill didn't have an elevator at Thunder Bay prior to that. So we took over National's elevator, and Yvon Chabot came from Baie-Comeau and ran the terminal elevator division, which included Baie-Comeau, Thunder Bay, the Cargill share of Prince Rupert, and the working agreement we had at Vancouver. We didn't have our own elevator. We had a throughput agreement with Pacific Elevators. And Yvon Chabot, who lives in Charleswood, ran that business.
I can't recall if we actually put this on tape the last time, but, and it may have been in the before the tape discussion. Can you run through, there were certain mergers, and you sort of mentioned it just previously about Cargill not having an elevator in Thunder Bay until it bought out National. So what were the amalgamations that took place there?
The major change in structures and the little race of amalgamation started, I think, around late 50s or very early 60s. McCabe was bought by National Grain Company, and then a little later Inter-Ocean Grain Company was bought by Richardson's. So two of the small companies gave up. But the big boys remained. You know, by the big boys, I mean the three pools, but the two big private companies were Searle and Federal. And they combined into one and merged. And that would have been around 68 or so. But by 1970, 71 or so, they gave up and sold out to the pools. And the pools, those two companies owned elevators in each province. Whereas the pools, of course, were provincial. And so SAS Pool bought all Searle's elevators in Saskatchewan, and Alberta Pool bought them in Alberta and Manitoba Pool in here. And that then remained, and then the next thing that happened, that lasted through the rest, but by 74, Cargill bought National. And that was the first to the extent that Federal and Searle were both very strongly Canadian private companies, historic Canadian families and whatever. There was, if you like, a continuity of Canadianism about those mergers, and even when they went into the pools and so on. Cargill's purchase was the first time a multinational had been on the prairie. We actually built the North Battleford rapeseed plant in 74-3, and we, all earlier, 72. And then that was our first investment in Western Canada. We had had the big investment in Baie-Comeau since 1960, 59-60, but we had not had any investments in the West. We bought all our grain from other grain companies and from the Wheat Board.
How would you describe your welcome into the Canadian.
It was very, very full of animosity. Mm. There was ugly, ugly headlines all over Saskatchewan, and it was really quite nasty. It got really personal and bitter, and big headlines saying, farmers are going to have to decide for themselves whether they want to market their grain to an elevator that they own, or to a foreign invader. And some of the language was a lot worse than that.
Were you in the country at the time?
Yes, very much so. Yeah. One of the reasons why it was contentious or so on was because the Russians had just completed their big businesses in 72, 3 and 4. And you may be aware that there were some very questionable practices at the Gulf Coast of Mexico on weights and grades. And it became known as the Great Grain Robbery. And a fellow from the Des Moines Register, Dan Morgan, wrote a big book called The Great Grain Robbery. And it turned out to be a good thing for Cargill because it broke Cargill out of its silent mode, and they were forced to sort of become more publicly proactive. And it turned out, of course, that he eventually endorsed Cargill and said that, we were the only one of the grain companies that was not involved and didn't do any of those shenanigans. And several of those people, in fact, did go to jail.
Can you say more about that? I haven't...
There were some charges of falsifying grades and falsifying weights, and chips were getting and arriving to foreign ports with the wrong grain in them. And so either there had been some shenanigans with the inspection system or whatever. And it was mostly at the Gulf. Cargill went to great lengths to also prove some stuff about handling grain that I think surprised the courts. You can take 2 yellow corn out of a bin with 3% foreign material or dockage in it and pour it into a ship, and when the ship is empty, that grain is coming out of the spout and falling 80 feet to the base of the hold, and then it climbs on a mound like this, and by the time it's nearly full, it's dropping 10 feet, and the grain at the bottom will have a higher percentage of breakage than the grain at the top, and it's difficult to load a ship so that it is completely uniform with exactly the same grain all the way through. And we did a number of tests, and there were some years there where corn was particularly brittle and dry and shattered. And I think it made the prosecutors a little more careful about what they charged in terms of falsely plugging ships with the wrong grain, when in fact that's a very difficult thing to prove. And however, they did do some, and but at least I think we got... Cargill had a research laboratory on handling of grain, and I think it served a great valuable role in letting everybody know that you don't just take grain out of the country and slap it into a ship without problems. Depending on the moisture of the grain, how quickly brittle it is, there are problems, and you've got to learn how to do it carefully. One of the results, and you'll see it at Thunder Bay, was telescopic spouts, which you've seen since then, that go up and down, so that the whole ship can be loaded with the grain falling the same amount. It starts at 10 feet, and as you get, you pull the telescopic spout up, and so on. A lot of work went into some of that research, and it did help to clarify some of the things that had looked like being either illegal or questionable or whatever.
Their grain research was done out of their Minneapolis
headquarters? Yes. Yeah, we had a grain research laboratory there, and we actually used it on later occasions to do some research drops. when canola first arrived, there was a major move in the University of Manitoba to change canola by reducing the amount of erucic acid in it. And that changed the oil content and that changed the amount of fiber and so on. And the result was that you could have ended up with a more valuable seed, but you've now weakened the hull and it splits too easily when you handle it. And split grain, especially canola, tends to heat afterwards and the moisture migrates in the bin. Problem. So we had, they were trying to come up with, if you had your choice as a geneticist and as a researcher in wheat or in canola, what would be the optimum thickness to keep the strength in the hull? And we did some work on that with the University of Manitoba and the University of Saskatoon, and they used that dropper and they photographed it one every thousandth of a second. You saw it hit and then you saw the little canola thing split, and then we were able to determine how, what would be a sensible hull thickness and hull strength to shoot for as a researcher in combination with the desire to have a different oil spectrum. That sort of thing. A lot of research went on in that lab on handling grain. And of course wheat is an easier subject to handle than corn. And I think the American grain system took a huge black eye over that issue at the Gulf of Mexico. And that's what the Saskatchewan papers were talking about when they said a foreign dishonest invader, you know, and they sort of lumped us in with all the others, which was wrong. So they did later retract that. But a legal retraction. But the fact is that corn is a heck of a lot tougher to handle than wheat. And some of those problems at the Gulf were a result of handling dry corn that would not have occurred handling dry wheat. Mm-hmm. So you have to be careful.
Did relationships change over time in your experience?
Yes, very much so. I think, you know, we worked with them a great deal. We brought an enormous amount of business to their elevators. We were playing such a huge part in export that, you know, we needed them. They needed us. Eventually, businessmen, for the most part, are pretty pragmatic. And a great deal of common sense began to show over the years. And we developed some fine and wonderful relationships with some very, very fine and great people. Guys like Milt Fair in Saspool and people like that and many others. And the same would be true of the wheat board. That relationships always go up and down. There's a tendency in Western Canada for the wheat board to be very popular and get a lot of support when times are very tough. And when times are very good, the right wing sort of tends to come to the front and say, who do we need, why do we need this wheat board in the way? And so as you swing the pendulum of good times and bad times through the decades, you'll see this relationship issue within the trade fluctuate. For the most part, the more sensible practitioners keep it at a pretty low level and get on with the job in hand. And plus the fact that whether you like the left-wing system of cooperative farm co-ops and all that stuff or not, or whether you like the wheat board system or not, is irrelevant. It happens to be the law of the land. So either, if you don't like it, get out, or obey the law. So, you know, most pragmatic business, you know what the law is before you come in the first place. So, you know, if you make an investment into that business, don't come in afterwards and say, that's not fair. You went in with your eyes wide open. Now, you can work to make changes while you're there, and you can have some run-ins and some tensions over certain things within the industry, and that's been common. But at the end of the day, you get on with the flipping job. The guy I worked for said, I'm not interested in you and your silly opinions, Dawson. You know, move more grain. And if that means getting off your high horse and working with some people whose opinions differ from yours, so be it, young man. Get to it.
Who was that?
What?
Who was that?
The owners of Cargill. I mean, yeah. You know, my boss.
And who was your boss at the time?
An American here called Earl Green, who was a tremendous guy, tremendous individual. And he himself was one of the breakers of much of that tension. He got on very well with the wheat board guys and with simply because of his personality. And he was the one that waved his finger at me and on that one occasion. Don't you ever forget, young man. Sleep, what do you say? Deal with honor, sleep at night. We had a big argument about some stuff that was going on. And he walked out of the office and left me to say, you sort it out. And that was his parting advice as he left. Pretty good advice. It made it a lot easier to make the decisions, too.
Did you work for certain changes over the time of your career?
Oh, yes. We were heavily involved in making the changes that got the first multiple carloads at an elevator at a discounted price for the number of cars. I mean, the very idea that putting 50 cars alongside an elevator and getting a 50-car load, or even, say, 25, as it was in those days, and even 18 when we started, if it's therefore more efficient, if you claim it's more efficient, shouldn't there be a lower freight rate? And when does the farmer get a piece of this great efficiency?
So this is loading at the...
At the country elevator.
Country elevator.
So, I mean, mm-hmm. If you're claiming that you want to get rid of all these farm elevators and small town elevators and build fewer, you know, focus the business into much larger ones, and the farmer drives further, so there's some increased costs for the farmer, and yet you tell me that this is a more efficient system. Maybe for you, but is it for me, the farmer? So we were very involved with the early developments of those variable freight rates, volume discounts. In fact, we loaded the first of those with the CN Rail, not with CP, interestingly enough, but with the government railroad. And that whole event over the years escalated from 18 cars to 25 to 50 and now 100 and so on. Now you've got much, much fewer very big elevators. And it's one of the problems that a historian, I'm sure an economic historian, would say, you know, coming in belatedly, the SAS pool suddenly sort of changed and they had younger management, or what's the word, not younger but more innovative management. And they realized that this was the way of the future, that the old system was going to break down.
The old system being?
Being lots and lots and lots of little country elevators in every town, the farmer driving 7 miles, and the railways stopping to drop off 3 cars every week at one little elevator. It was going to go to much, much bigger elevators with 50 and 100 car spots, drops, and so on. And so as they did that, they started to spend enormous sums of money themselves to maintain their market share, their percentage, which was very high. Something like 60% of the grain in Saskatchewan was going to the Saskatchewan pool elevators after they merged with Federal Searle, after they bought Federal Searle. Prior to that, it had been about 30-35%, but that merger with Federal Searle doubled their ratio, their percentage. And they tried to sort of hold that and keep that afterwards, and they suddenly joined in and started building. Well, I'm not just sure how much, but well over $200 million was spent in that exercise. And that had a major bearing. You just can't make that kind of money in the grain business. And that had a major bearing on the weakness of the financial balance sheet that, you know, finally led to their collapse. Prior to that, they'd gone out and had United Grain Growers had done something similar. They solved their problem by selling stock to Archer Daniel Miller, the big multinational from the States. who owned 26% or so of UGG. And Manitoba Pool merged with Alberta Pool and formed Agricor. Sasspool did not join. UGG, which was not in one province but right across Canada, across the prairie, they were on their own for a bit. Later on, they joined Alberta Pool and Man Pool, and that became Agri United. And then that collapsed, and Viterra was formed out of the merger of Saskatchewan Pool and all of that group. So Viterra is really the result, the end result of all of those mergers. Today, therefore, you have got a different boardroom on different management exercise running the business. There is a definite move that says if you don't make a profit, you don't survive. Prior to that, you know, I grew up in an era when service at cost was the motto of the Saskatchewan Wheat Pool, a farmer-owned business. And its weakness was a refusal to understand that in a business that doesn't make a profit fails. You can't keep up with the times, replace property and plant and equipment and run your business if you don't make a profit. Now, there can be a new debate that talks what is a sensible and reasonable, acceptable profit and what is an abusive profit. That is a subject that's totally open for debate, rather pregnant one right in this particular stage in business history in North America. But the people who take risks and don't get them paid for don't survive. And really, it isn't that much of a surprise that there are no co-ops left today out of those that group. There are some very successful co-ops on the prairie.
We sort
one
of
here, Red River Valley Co-op in mm-hmm. Manitoba, is a very, very strong financial co-op, well run and so on. So really the debate is what is a sensible, acceptable, fair profit.
We sort of moved away from talking about Thunder Bay and the elevator there. Any changes occur in the operation in Thunder Bay?
Well, I think, yes, there was a...
that other than the cars?
Yeah, for the most part, most of those grain companies made reasonably good profits at the terminals and very poor earnings in the country. And as a company, they would declare, you know, a rather poor performance year, but black, in the black. Well, most of that came from terminals, not from the country elevator division. For the most part, the terminal elevators subsidized the earning power of the company, and the country elevator operations weakened it.
And the profits made at the terminal elevator were from storage?
No. Storage, either at the country elevator and at the terminal, has never been enough to make any money with. You'd go broke on storage earnings. You make money by turning grain through the elevators, making elevations. There are some opportunities to make money. You know, a terminal elevator is more of a working warehouse. It's a factory, you know, and you should, if you were using it optimally, treat it that way. And in Duluth and in the United States, they do. And they'll take in number 2 and 3 and 4 and put them in separate bins. And the guy comes in from Germany and says, well, I want to buy number 3. And they will manufacture, by bleeding those 3 together, exactly number 3. And they'll know that in number 3 you've got to have a certain percentage of this and so on. And you learn to blend with great skill to meet the buyer's requirements. That's prohibited in Canada. Number 2 is number 2 and number 3 is number 3. So Only under very dire circumstances, when the wheat board would get short grain, would they permit an elevator, and they would control it and say, we will buy from you 10,000 tons of number two, and we will sell back to you 20,000 tons of number three, and the elevator would do the blending and so on. But it wasn't a normal practice in Canada to blend, either at Vancouver or Thunder Bay. And by so doing, you walk away from one of the value-added opportunities that you've got. An elevator shouldn't be something that takes grain in, sticks it up a leg, holds it for a month, puts it in the car, and ships it out. The value-added common sense things to do with that is to enhance it. And if you've got a small quantity of 5 grain or 4 grain, and you've got some very strong number one, and you can marry those up and get a high demand for the number two that you make, you have played the role of enhancing manufacturer rather than being just a warehouseman. The Americans do a lot of the skilled warehouse stuff. We don't do an awful lot of that. We're learning now. Some relaxations have occurred, and because they needed to. You go to an elevator in Vancouver to pick up 22,000 tons of number two, and they've only got 19,000. So you take the enormous ship at huge expense across the harbour to another elevator to pick up 3,000 tons. I mean, you know, it doesn't make any sense when, with some skill, that elevator is perfectly capable of taking a limited amount of number three, bleeding it carefully onto the belts over the whole movement of 22. You don't put 22 in and then on top put three the other. You bleed the three in all day long and it disappears in there. And if the number two is strong and well clear of the limits, it'll take the number three and you'll lose it. You've now cut out another shift across the harbour. You're still within the proper grade. Everybody's happy. And you have promoted some three north and into number two. Well, that's just money for the system. I mean, in the wheat board's case, they paid the farmer for some three. When he delivered at the elevator, he got paid for three. When the wheat board sold it to Japan, it was number two. That's enhancing earnings for the farmer. And a grain elevator company, if you don't have that in, but if we did that in canola, you've enhanced it and it enables you to pay the farmer more.
Going to shift gears a little bit here, because in thinking back to our last interview, we sort of stopped your career after you got back to Geneva, or into Geneva, and then we sort of talked about the difference between seeing the grain industry from the outside of the country rather inside. So maybe what happened to you after Geneva? Where did you go then?
I went to Vancouver.
Okay.
For a couple of years.
As?
Manager of the Vancouver and the Eastern Export, the Western Export Operation.
Okay.
Which in those days was primarily Japan. I was there from 69 to 72. There was big business going on to China. We didn't do business with Korea as much then. That was just coming in. It was very largely dominated by Japan.
Did you notice any difference between working with the Eastern countries versus working with the European countries? Or was it pretty much the same?
Yeah. It gets difficult. Trading with the sort of the occidental world of Europe and the standards that they expect in documentation and in performance and in ethics are pretty high and are pretty well established by, you know, many hundreds of years almost of business practice. When you move from there and you start to trade with some of the other countries that haven't got that long history of ethics, you've got to be careful, because you will run into problems of payment, for one thing.
Getting paid?
Yeah. And they just do more things and they'll argue about stuff. Trading Canadian grain was always very, very pleasant, and not pleasant is too weak a word, was enhanced by the rigidity of our Canadian Grain Commission. By having a Grain Commission Certificate of Weight and a National Grain Certificate of Grade and a Port Warden Certificate of Cleanliness, and etc., the whole system, with very tight, well-run, you know, I've often claimed that the Canadian Grains Commission is probably the best-run bureaucracy in the Canadian government. And it enabled an international grain seller to run around the world, and you could sell, everybody knew what they were going to get. They knew they weren't going to get cheated. The system, the inspectors don't work for the companies. The inspectors work for the government. And so it's quite different from the United States. And it made selling Canadian grain a lot easier because it had eliminated argument. And that became very important when you shift and you start selling, you know, in the Orient or in parts of the Middle East, where funny practices and backsheesh is
common. Under the table.
Like, you know.
Payments.
They'll pay an inspector, bribe them. And so we've been free of that in Canada. It's been fun because we don't have to manage the ugly issue of corruption. It's been very rare over the years in Canada. I can't even remember a case that was based on dishonesty and corruption. There's been some on negligence or incompetence, but not on that stuff.
So after you left?
And that would be true, particularly of the Grains Commission, but also true of the board, the Wheat Board.
So after you left BC, then, back to Winnipeg?
No, went to Argentina. Yeah.
And what?
And I ran the export business for the Argentinian Cargill, which was largely to Europe. And some of it was in wheat, but nearly all in corn and soybeans.
And what differences, similarities did you see there with practices and operations?
Argentina is somewhere between those two extremes that I talked about earlier. You had to be careful. To my great astonishment, when I loaded the first ship after I'd arrived there, I deliberately asked in the department for them to bring me all the documents. I wanted to just learn. I didn't know what they were. And they arrived on the desk, and there was the certificate of weight in exactly the same logo, filigree, at the top as the Canadian Grain Commission certificate of weight. Exactly the same. It was a copy. And in all it said, instead of saying Board of Grain Commissioners, which is what it was called before it was the Canadian Grain Commission, it was the Board of Grain Commissioners, it said the Junta Nacional de Granos. I looked in, and everything, even the word, the weight and the date and everything were all in the same place. I said, this is amazing. And so I asked about it. And one of the guys said, well, in 1946, at the World Wheat Conference in England, Dr. Dussel, the head of the Argentine Wheat Board, was talking to a Dr. Trelevin from the Canadian Wheat Board and saying he was trying to set up a very tight system to help Argentina. Could Doug help him? So Doug did indeed help him, sent him a copy of the documents. He just changed the documents and changed it from English to Spanish, and their certificates are the same as ours. I don't think they run theirs quite as well as ours is run, but close. They would be miles ahead of many other countries and running a business and exporting it from Argentina wasn't that big a difference from here, particularly in the wheat and so on. The waterfront is a little tougher. You know, stevedores and things. We had, Canada was exporting CANDUs to Argentina, reactors. Mm-hmm. And it sat on the dock in Argentina for ages, rotting. And they couldn't get it through the thing, and the Canadian ambassador came to us and said, yeah, listen, could you guys, you know, help at all? So I did some sniffing around, and I went with our stevedore down to the docks and stuff. And he said, well, they haven't done the right things. And so I went back to the member and said, there's things you have to do. And he said, well, what? He said, I can't do those. So he said, well, we'll fix it up. And so we fixed it up and got the things moved inland and so on. But we had to perform some stuff that ambassadors can't do. And it was very awkward. But, and I think, you know, in some of those countries, you go in there, and I wondered about it when I went to Argentina, and I specifically asked, am I going to be asked to do things that are less than above board? And I remember very clearly the head of the department in Minneapolis saying to me, have you ever been asked to do that before? No. Well, why the hell do you think we should start asking you now? On the contrary, you're going down there to make sure that we don't do that kind of thing. And so when I got there, you couldn't get a driving license unless you had a cedular certificate of immigration, transit, you know, landing visa. But you couldn't get a landing visa unless you got a driving license. So I took a fixer guy with me, and he put $20 in between each page and so on, and you're through the system and out of there with your driving license. Most of the employees on the other side of that counter would be paid less than $30 or $40 a month, $50 a month. The local policeman would be less than that. And streets would pay them. And the system is built around a certain amount of that being in the system.
Sort of like an unofficial tip.
Exactly. When you get down there, you got to just learn to go with the flow a little bit. And the question is to keep it dignified and decent and not dirty. And I mean really dirty. Mm-hmm.
Could you?
I mean, you know, none of this business of going down to the red light district and, you know, all the dirty stuff. Just a little bit of money or something sensible. And our kids walked around on the shoulders of the big giant policeman that patrolled our thing. He was huge. And the kids, he'd carry our little kids up on his shoulder. He was a great guy, and we were all part of looking after them, make sure his family got properly fed and so on. He was mowed down by the terrorists and killed. Mm-hmm. And the kids were asking where he was and stuff. So, and it's amazing. You have to go through some mental shifts as you do move into some of those countries. And the question is, can you keep it dignified and decent and not get into the nasty stuff?
Did you find you could and still be profitable?
Yes, absolutely. No question. So long as you sort of stayed in with what you might call their local customs, so on, you were fine. But there's a fine grey line between there and some of the big operations which move on into everything from booze to drugs to women. I mean, you know, the whole dirty game. And those things do go on. Mm. And the thing to do is to keep clear of all that garbage, which can be done and which was actually quite easy to do if you really wanted. You didn't have to play that game to get it.
What was their physical plant like there?
In Argentina?
Yeah.
It was built by C.D. Howe, who built the elevators in Thunder Bay. You walk into the elevator in downtown on the harbour front and in Buenos Aires, you'd think you were walking into number 4 Saspool and in Thunder Bay. Almost identical. Almost the same plans. Built both elevators. Foundation company, C.D. Howe, Canada, built those elevators. And you'll see those elevators in Salvador, you'll see them in Africa, you'll see them everywhere.
Whereabouts in Africa?
Nigeria.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm. So how long was your stint in Argentina?
2.5 years, 2 years.
And then back?
To Winnipeg. Cargill bought, I was there 72, 74. Cargill bought National Grain in 74. And they wanted someone back here who, you know, knew the Canadian system and so on. So that's when I came back.
And what position were you in at that
point? I was
point?
Sort of number two. I mean, there was a president and I was the senior vice president. And, you know, we bought a feed company, National Feeds, and we had a seed company. And we had the grain, the Western grain business, plus our own Cargill export business. We even had a business down east that they had. So we had made a number of changes. It changed the whole picture of Cargill, that purchase. And it's difficult to sort of say how significant that purchase was in the march of the change in Canadian agriculture. I don't think it was anywhere near as big or important as the later moves by the pools, which is felt more recent. But I mean, certain it is that the landscape of Canadian agriculture today is massively different than it was prior to the disappearance of the pools. And there are some negatives in that. I mean, there isn't a single farmer-owned voice representing and championing the farmer viewpoints left. I mean, at one time there were three pools doing it and UGG, and then that went down to two and then down to South Pool, then it folded up into Viteria, now public company owned by shareholders saying, you know, where's the dividends? You know, there's a totally different managerial expectation there. And in fact, the only sort of really strong farmer advocate today would be the wheat board. And yet they're really an exporter. So they get caught a little bit. You know, you see in the paper their strategy being so farmer-oriented. Shouldn't be. It should be customer-oriented. If that was an export company that I was managing, you don't look backwards to your source, you look to your customers for your future. And so on. So there are, the wheat board has got a little bit, it wears two hats at times. That's a tough thing to do. And but their need to take on the farmer responsibility is almost thrust upon them by the disappearance of the farmer companies. And it's left the industry in a little way. If one was in Ottawa as a bureaucrat in the Department of Agriculture or in foreign trade and stuff, the only people coming to see you are representatives from multinational companies with investments in Canada. It's not quite true, because there still are some very big Canadian players. James Richardson's is a very strong and well-run company. Patterson, now they're smaller, but well-run and stable. And same true with Patterson, with Parrish and Heimbecker, doing well and have every reason to believe that they are in good shape.
It's always hard to predict, but I'm interested in your thoughts about, you know, saying that the voice of the farmer from a sort of business operating to handle grain.
Yes.
Any predictions of what might play out there?
Well, it has, the history of it has led to the farmer genuinely feeling that he has a right to all of the value of the grain that arrives in the Japanese flour mill. And he has been not well or fairly or properly educated that the value of grain at his farm is one thing, the value of grain at the elevator is now slightly higher. The value of grain at the port is again slightly higher. And he can't understand why his grain is worth $200 a ton, and we make sales at $300 a ton to Japan, and I want that $100. Well, there's a lot of services being provided in that line before it gets to the Japanese mill at 300. And the lack of recognition by the farmer that this is what the business is about, is this transporting, warehousing, improving, cleaning, taking care of, putting in ships and getting it over there, and so on, and financing it all, it is a very sophisticated exercise. And when they did it for themselves as prairie co-ops, not so much so that they even formed their own export company called XCAM, they went bust. It ain't that easy. Our approach was, come on in, buddy, the water's fine. A little rough at times, but welcome. So they came in and they went out. So it is a sophisticated game. It's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
Getting grain from a farm bin to an overseas customer in good condition is not an easy exercise. And the farmer has been poorly informed about what has to take place and how do you get that job done. And he was kept somewhat in the dark by the system that he owned and so on. So as you make the shift today, that educational process is underway. And the farmer to this day still has pretty high expectations that someone is ripping him off. You know, which is an unfortunate and unpleasant way to do business. You know, it's worth your while to spend some time, effort, and money to educate your main supplier that that is not the case. And so you see companies like Cargill going to considerable efforts to do that.
I think this would be a good time to take a little break, B. Would you agree?
I think it would be an excellent time to break because I've got some coffee on and I've got some
just the stuff.
You could have a